The essence of history is paradox. Man is a thinking animal who is both the creature and creator of history, knowing both necessity and freedom. Herbert Muller, paraphrasing the great theologian and philosopher Reinhold Niebuhr in his book, The Uses of the Past. Welcome to Delmarva Today. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. My guest is Dr. Darren Lowery. Dr. Lowery is director of the Chesapeake Watershed Archaeological Research Foundation. He is also an adjunct professor at Penn State University at the Mount Alto campus in Mount Alto, Pennsylvania. And he is also a research associate and fellow in the Department of Anthropology at the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of Natural History. Dr. Lowery, welcome to Delmarva Today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for joining me. Let me begin by asking what the Chesapeake Watershed Archaeological Research Foundation is and what kind of research you conduct.
Well, back when I was an undergraduate in a graduate school, there were two, and there still are, two polar opposites as to investigating the archaeological record of the Chesapeake. You have the purely academic perspective, which can be driven by program histories and circumstance. And then you have the state agency kind of review and compliance, usually what they call cultural resource management. The two are at polar opposites. And as a kid growing up on Tillman Island, I got interested in archaeology, but mainly because of loss or erosion. And coastal erosion was the catalyst for me getting interested in archaeology. And I, over the years, saw significant archaeological sites come and go. And I figured, okay, the best way to be proactive is to take a different stance. And that different stance is to be neither pure academic or pure cultural resource oriented, but mainly to salvage as much information as possible before it disappears.
So
that's what we do.
Do you publish your research, or how is your research used?
Some of them are giant monographs. I've uploaded a bunch to, there's a website called academia.edu, and you can download many surveys, peer-reviewed articles, summaries. With every peer-reviewed article, there's usually some reason behind it. It's usually a giant monograph. Some of the monographs I don't upload just because, you know, they're it's kind of like watching paint dry to read. But the point being is the peer-reviewed articles give you an idea of the dissemination of information on the scholarly academic level. And then the monographs are largely a byproduct of large-scale regional surveys or site-focused excavations. There are a few book chapters that I've uploaded primarily to disseminate to a global audience rather than just a local audience what the Chesapeake has to offer. And I think the other day I checked, because you get pinged every day how many who downloads and whatever else, but basically there have been over 48,000 downloads of those articles, monographs, and book chapters, and even PowerPoint presentations from a global audience. I used to tell folks there were like two countries that folks didn't download stuff. One was Lesotho in South Africa, and the other one was Kazakhstan. But I've since closed that gap. So believe it or not, in every populated country of the globe, around the globe, there's somebody that has read something about the Chesapeake archaeological record.
That's very significant. How has the pandemic impacted your work at the foundation? I know how it's impacted your work at the university because you're teaching remotely, I understand, like a lot of other people are right now.
Well, generally with archaeology and archaeological research, social isolation is generally part of it, especially some of the islands that I've worked on in the past. The Atlantic coastal islands are pretty far out there, some of the ones in the Chesapeake. The only impact that's had is, the number of people that could be involved in a project. It didn't stop me from doing field work. I remember, driving and launching a boat when it looked like the interstates were desolate no man's land. And actually, I found it pretty comfortable because then I didn't have to worry about getting run over by a car.
Your work then, you go to remote locations. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, yeah. I mean, like the one island I've been working on, it's a 70-acre, actually it's less than that now because it's eroding. But it's about a 70-acre island, and the only human being there would be me and the caretaker and the caretaker's dog. And I think a 70-acre buffer is adequate enough for social isolation.
What island is that, Darren?
It's Parsons Island. It's part of it was originally a peninsula connected to Kent Island. And, historically, it has become separate from the mainland. And we began working out there on and off since 2013. And this year, with grant funding from the Maryland Historical Trust and some funding from Preservation Maryland, along with prior funding from the Smithsonian and other private individuals, we were able to get out there and do some initial testing. This coming year, we hope to have the Center for Study of the First Americans faculty from Texas A&M up along with field crew to work on it. They were going to be out there this year, but because of the pandemic, that was not an option.
Well, Parsons Island, I'm familiar with. I've actually not been on the island, but I live on Kent Island. So Parsons Island is literally right up the street from where I live. And when I go out in my little boat, I often go down and circle around Parsons Island. But what are you finding there?
Well, Parsons is one of the few Upper Bay Islands. I mean, there are several, but it's privately owned and it's also eroding. And the landowners have been very, very cordial and helpful. If anything, they, having an interested landowner is very important. Generally, 90% of the time, you're either dealing with state or federal agencies. I'd much rather deal with a private landowner. So we're investigating a couple things. One, the long-term geologic history of the Chesapeake, and also some of the earliest evidence of peoples in the New World, or at least potential earliest evidence of people in the New World.
What kind of data, let me ask it in my layman's way, what are you finding?
Okay,
No, go ahead, please.
Okay, there at Parsons Island, there's a buried surface. It would be kind of like having 50,000 dump truck loads coming in your backyard and burying your lawn. And after 20,000 years, you can still see the organic stain of that surface, because once you bury it and it's buried rapidly, the plants, the organic material gets preserved. And there is at Parsons Island a series of buried surfaces, not just one, several, and they're stacked one on top of the other. Those surfaces, the earliest one is around 42,000 years old. The next one is around 36. Then there's one at around 28 to 30. And then the youngest one is around 20,000 years old. And what we have in those surfaces are the plants that were growing on the landscape during that 20,000 year interval, because it's basically 40 to 20. And also we have some animals, the soils of the Delmarva are not particularly conducive to the preservation of bone, but generally you end up with teeth. I happen to have one of the teeth right here. It's a small molar. It's not that big. Most people wouldn't pay attention to it, but it's actually a camel called Hemia alkina, macrocephala, the large-headed llama. And it came from Parsons Island. Now, I can't tell you whether this animal is 42,000 or 20,000 years old. I could date this and determine within some probability.
Sure.
But the point being, it's been a long time since camels have lived on Ken Island or in the Upper Bay.
I had no idea that camels ever lived on Kent Island.
Well, there are other animals there too. There's woodland muskox, stag moose. There's also a giant bison called Bison latifrons, which is a very large bison. So when you look at the animals that were living in the area, and again, it's only teeth, they give you a different perspective of how different the Chesapeake region was, you know, 20 to 40,000 years ago. Now, in the youngest surface that's out there, the 20,000-year surface, in 2013, so that's 7 years ago, we noticed a few stone artifacts. Now, that's not the only site in the Chesapeake that's produced artifacts in a layer that has old ages, so it's not unique in that sense. But in 2013, we started to find a few artifacts exposed in that 20,000-year surface. And initially, we just mapped them in and documented the ones that had eroded out of context. And then in 2017, the Smithsonian did some initial testing along the bank edge. They found another artifact in the excavation. It was not necessarily diagnostic, but the date that they got on the charcoal associated with that artifact was on the order of around 21,000 years ago. Now, the importance of that is that the earliest evidence of the peoples in the New World is not necessarily contested, anything around 13,000. 13,000, everybody's, you know, in agreement. Anything older than that becomes kind of a hotly debated topic among ivory tower scholars who have their opinions. The site itself is interesting because as the shorelines retreated, we found more and more stuff in the bank profile. And as a result, we've been able to document more fully the extent of the site. And this year we had proceeded in doing test excavations from the top down and documenting if there was anything in situ associated with that layer. And we have found a few artifacts. So next year's field season is going to see how far inland, what's the aerial extent of it, and then further refine the chronology. You know, it's not uncommon to see artifacts associated with surfaces that they're not affiliated with. Objects get eroded out of context on a landscape and from a shoreline, and this would be on a landscape. So it's highly probable that these artifacts have been, you know, deposited on a surface with carbon, charcoal material that's not associated with it. However, about 2 years ago, we had a scientist out there who did some extraction samples of the overlying sediments. And the overlying sediments are windblown, mainly sand and silt. And there was a time when there was a lot of sand and silt blowing around across the landscape. And there's a type of dating technique called optically stimulated luminescence dating. It's a way of dating the background absorbed radiation over time. The longer it's buried, the more radiation it absorbs. It's a ballpark proxy, and we had a series of these dates constructed in the layers above where we found artifacts, and they're all consistent. The overlying sediments are roughly 19,000 to 17,000 years old, so you would expect the overlying sediments to be younger than the underlying sediments. The current, you know, given the current range of dates, you know, it would look like somebody's there at least sometime around 20,000, but maybe as young as 17,000 years old. So somewhere in that time frame, we can't tell within a narrow point, but clearly it had to be buried, and people don't typically live on surfaces after they're buried. So
do the artifacts lend any evidence to you, Darren, of who the carriers of those artifacts might be?
Not necessarily. You know, I've had the debate with people. You know, you can go into downtown Annapolis and excavate a 18th century well or privy, and you can find Chinese export porcelain. And it doesn't mean the Chinese invaded Annapolis in the 18th century. You know, there's a lot of material that's trading around at certain periods of time. Now, this may not be the byproduct of trade, but there's also connecting identity, point of origin, is pretty hard to do. And I use this as an example. There was a treatise a few years ago on which I was a contributor, and it was dealing with a culture that appeared in most of Eastern North America around 1300 years ago. It's very distinctive, sticks out like a sore thumb. And you could fill warehouses with the archaeological data. There are cemeteries, there's living sites, fishing encampments, you name it. When you read the whole treatise of papers, there are some of the authors equate that distinctive technology with proto-Iroquoian speakers, so people that were speaking Iroquoian language. Some equate it to proto-Algonquian speakers. Some equate it to proto-Siouan speakers. And some, like myself, you know, basically said, I don't know what it means. So when you can have an archaeological database that can fill multiple warehouses, and you can't, and it's only 1300 years old, and the consensus is there is no consensus, it makes things much older seem a little bit more problematic about determining point of origin. And, you know, I use the historic record or proto-historic record as a good analog. The analogy that I use to better understand the complexities of linking artifacts with people, you can go to the sites in Western North Carolina during the time of English contact, and you can find certain projectile points. They're basically trianguloid in outline. And then you can go to sites on the James River, the York River, same era, same time period, and you can find triangular points. And you can go to Western New York State during the same time period and find triangular points. Exactly the same, made the same fashion, whatever. The ones in Western New York are Iroquoian speakers. The ones on the James River are Algonquian speakers. And the ones in Western North Carolina are Siouan speakers. So here's a great example of how, you know, they look identical across space, but they represent different people who are speaking a radically different language. And they also represent individuals who came from to the Americas at different time periods in successful migrations.
Well, let me shift gears. This is really fascinating, and I wish we had a lot more time. And perhaps we will at another time, if you would be willing to come back and talk about these indigenous peoples. But I wanted to ask you, with the fires in the West and the two Antarctic glaciers now that appear to be breaking free from their restraint, climate change has surfaced again, mm-hmm. thank goodness, as an important topic for us. What perspectives do archaeology and you've talked a bit about geology as well, offer on issues like climate change and the attendant sea level rise?
Okay, well, that's actually a great question. I kind of anticipated something like that because, you know, climate change I never have a problem with. I really don't. I mean, climate has been changing for eons and will continue to change. The question is, you know, what role are we playing in that? And I don't think that's fully understood. But the past provides a perspective. You know, if those folks living at Parsons Island were there at 20,000 years ago, 20,000 years ago, there was a gigantic ice sheet in the Northern Hemisphere. And that ice sheet extended all the way down throughout the Northeast and stopped in northern New Jersey and north central Pennsylvania. And that ice sheet was, you know, at its center, upwards of a couple miles in thickness. So Parsons Island, Kent Island, the Delmarva Peninsula was immediately in front of an ice sheet, a massive ice sheet, that basically drove the climate of the region. Intensive winds were blowing out of the northwest, but more importantly, with all that water locked up in that ice sheet, sea level at that time was in excess of around 400 feet lower than they is today, than it is today. So the Chesapeake that we cross today when you go from Annapolis to Kent Island didn't exist. It was a valley. It was an extension of the Susquehanna. And matter of fact, at that time, the Chesapeake Bay would have been confined to the bounds of the Norfolk Canyon. If you look at any bathymetry map of the continental shelf, you'll see the Norfolk Canyon. So, you know, 20,000 years ago, the folks living at Parsons Island would have had to go to the Norfolk Canyon to experience or utilize the resources of the primordial Chesapeake Bay. Meanwhile, and here's one of those artifacts from Parsons Island. This one, by the way, we did test it for residue, and it does have blood residue of camelid. Remember, I showed you the camel tooth.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
This one actually has blood residue on it of a camelid. And then you jump later in time to 13,000 years ago when you have the undisputed first peoples in the Americas. At that time, sea levels were around 160 feet lower than they are today. So between 20 and 13, sea levels rose almost 200 feet. So the point being is, you know, sea levels are on the rise, and sea level rise has been occurring, and people have been experiencing that. So when this point was made and lost in the Chesapeake, this is a classic Clovis point, sea levels were 160 feet. And then we get a little bit later. This point here was found at Love Point. This one's about 2,000 years old. At 2,000 years ago, sea levels would have been about 6 to 7 feet lower. So when this individual here was butchering a camel, sea levels were 400. This individual here could have been hunting an elephant. Sea levels were 160. And then when this individual lost this, sea levels were only 7 feet lower. This guy or gal or individual ate oysters.
Yeah,
so the bay itself is...
Let me note for our radio audience that the items are look like arrowheads, and they get a little bit smaller and sharper as you went down through the list.
Well, yeah, when I showed representative samples, I mean, I could show you the inversion, you know, bigger and later. But the point being is humans have been adapting to a changing ecosystem, a changing climate, and changing sea levels for a very long period of time. And matter of fact, I usually get some wrinkles from people, and I usually ruffle some feathers when I ask them, what is the warmest interval in the last 10,000 years? And the Greenland ice sheet preserves that. There are several cores that have been extracted, and using certain isotopes, you can reconstruct it. And it's actually not today. When this 2,000-year-old point was being lost on Love Point, northern hemispheres were actually a little bit warmer than they are today. When you go back 7,500 years ago, and the northern hemisphere was a lot warmer than it is today. However, there's still rotten ice. I call it rotten ice. It's kind of like a parking lot after a blizzard where they piled up all the snow and it's a 70 degree day. It's still there. It's lingering. So climate change is just part of the system. Sea level rise is part of the system. If you look around the bay, if you look at the western shore, there are key indicators that sea levels were much higher than they were during the geologic past. All you have to do is look at Calvert Cliffs. That's the bottom of the ocean bed. And guess what? 16 million years ago, sea levels were a lot higher than they are today. So it's all perspective. It all depends on your interval of time, your starting point. And when you see glaciers calve off of the Antarctic ice sheet, or the Arctic, like Greenland, that hit the news just this week. it's not particularly unusual. That's what ICE does. The question is, what's the future hold for us? And I guess we'll just have to wait and see.
I guess the only thing I would add to that is, and as a scientist, obviously you're up to date on this, it is the change in human impact on, on the environment. And that's new. That's even though there have been clearly cycles of warming and cooling as this Earth has gone through its life, it has never, I don't believe anyway, you can correct me, experienced anything akin to the impact that human habitation currently is having on the on the environment.
Oh yeah, I mean, we are, you know, the several years ago, they denote the period of time we're in is no longer the Holocene, it's the Anthropocene. It's the period of time when humans are driving this. But, you know, a colleague of mine at the Smithsonian, you know, they I don't know whether you've ever been to the Human Origins exhibit. If you look at our ancestors, hominids, you know, we've been around for, or at least our, you know, hominid forms have been around for, you know, three or more million years in some form thereof. However, what's interesting is when you look at the traits that we have, bipedalism, large brain size, what's interesting is that there's usually a direct correlation with increased brain size in hominids. And it starts at around 2 to 2.5 million years ago. And do you know what that correlates with? The onset of the ice ages, the Pleistocene. So, you know, leading up to that, brain size were pretty much constant. And then boom, for some odd reason, that had nothing to do with us, the global cycles of glaciers and interglacials accelerated. And it makes sense. I mean, those hominids that were more pliable and able to adapt to rapidly changing ecological systems survived. And it just so happens that those had larger brain capacity. So ironically, when I talked to students about that, I said, you know, we are essentially a byproduct of climate change. You know, our gigantic, you know, skulls and heads, the constraints of giving birth to a child through a pelvis that, you know, is designed for bipedalism, is, you know, just a byproduct of the changes that have occurred over the last couple million years. And, you know, it's a complicated question. And, you know, I do not doubt that humans are playing a role, but the pattern that was set forth over the last 2.5 million years is driven by solar insolation and the orbital path of the Earth around the sun and the axial tilt of the Earth, all of which are outside of our control. And, you know, I don't doubt that we're affecting systems. We clearly caused animals to become extinct. There are no camels on Kent Island anymore. There's no camels in North America. Here's a mammoth tooth. Guess what? Humans played a role in the demise of that that species as well. So the point being is we are a formidable foe and we are a tool-dependent species.
Dr. Lowry, I want to thank you very much for coming on the program today. And I want to thank you.
Yeah, appreciate it.
Well, I want to thank you for the discussion and for the lively discussion. Thank you very much. And I want to thank all of our listeners for tuning in today as well. This is Delmarva Today. I'm your host, Harold Wilson.